Okay. On page 59 in the Church Bibles, Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face, because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, What is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Say to the Israelites, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel, and say to them, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. The elders of Israel will listen to you. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he will let you go. And I will make the Egyptians favorably disposed towards this people, so that when you leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman is to ask her neighbor and any woman living in her house for articles of silver and gold and for clothing, which you will put on your sons and daughters. And so you will plunder the Egyptians. Exodus chapter 4, on page 60 in the Church Bible. Moses answered, What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, The Lord did not appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, What is that in your hand? A staff, he replied. The Lord said, Throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Then the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. Now put it back into your cloak, he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they do not believe you or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. The Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. But Moses said, pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so that you can perform the signs with it.
So, good morning. If you don't know me, my name is Chris Ox, and I also want to wish you a happy new year. Now, whether 2014 is going to be happy for you, I don't know, of course. I know my 2014 will probably be very different because we're looking to join a mission organization, WEC, and so that has probably a lot of changes coming towards us. And so I would, of course, hope that these changes are happy, but to be honest, I think happiness is probably not the best measure to evaluate a year. What makes a year good or bad for a Christian is not necessarily happiness, but whether you walk with God, I would argue. And I'm pretty sure that if you are a follower of Jesus, if you are a follower of the way, you will agree. Your walk with God in the ups and downs of life, that's what gives life meaning, depth. That's what gives hope to everything. And so that's what makes a year good or bad, whether you walk with God. And so that's what I would like to talk about this morning, walking with God. Now, who is this God you're walking with? And how do you walk with him? And what keeps you from walking with God? So those are the three points I would like to look at. Now, there are lots of passages in the Bible that I could be looking at to discuss the idea of walking with God, but I would like to look at this encounter that Moses has here with God at the burning bush in Exodus 3. And the reason I want to do that is because, in a sense, Moses begins his walk with God here. And I think we can make a lot of important observations about what it means to walk with God from this passage. And so I will run through the whole passage, so it would be really good if you have that open in front of you. Now, who is God? Now, we begin the story here in the desert. But it's, of course, not where Moses' story has started. We're already in chapter 3 here. His story starts in chapter 1, in a sense, much earlier. Moses is in the desert because he messed up. He had to run away from Egypt, where he was born. He had to come away from his family, his friends, because he had killed an Egyptian. He tried to help a fellow Hebrew, but he ended up making a mess of things. And so by killing this Egyptian, he forfeited the blessing of his upbringing. As a baby, he was adopted into the family of Pharaoh, the god king of Egypt, and he had therefore enjoyed the most privileged of upbringings. He didn't have to worry about food or water, where that came from. He presumably didn't have to work. He probably had a good loo. People underestimate that. He probably had access to physicians, and he learned to read and write. But all that was gone now. Now he was living his life at the backside of the desert. And literally in the Hebrew, it says here, behind the desert. So it's really far out. And the word Horeb in verse 1 here actually means something like wasteland or desolate. And so Moses, who was once a prince, so to speak, he's now reduced to this desert Bedouin or this nomad shepherd living in the desert. But we meet him here in verse 2. Moses sees a burning bush. And that's, of course, nothing special because, you know, spontaneous combustion is known to happen in the desert. You know, the light reflects funny from a piece of quartz. A fire starts. So it's probably not super common, but I imagine that that was nothing too strange for Moses, who had lived 40 years in the desert by this point. But there's then also something very strange going on, something extraordinary happening. Verse 3, the bush doesn't burn up. There's an unquenchable flame that doesn't consume the wood. And so curiosity makes Moses turn. And you see, this is how it often begins, how our walk with God often starts. At times, perhaps, restarts after we've gotten stuck in the desert. We experience something quite ordinary, but yet also something strange is happening, something that perks our interest. And let me suggest to you that this is precisely how God shows up. Think about how you became a Christian. I'm sure there are many factors in your life, and all of our stories are different. But wasn't it those people, those special Christians that you met that appeared so normal, so ordinary, and yet something quite extraordinary was going on with them, something strange? There was an unquenchable flame. Now, in the book of Exodus, God appears in fire. You have God here in the burning bush. You have the pillar of fire by night that leads the Israelites through the desert. You have the fire on Mount Sinai when God comes down and the whole mountain is aflame. And then you have the fires of the tabernacle that consume the sacrifices. So God appears in fire. And I think it's not coincidental that in the book of Acts then that the coming of the Holy Spirit of God is also in little flames, in little pillars of fire. You see, the Spirit-filled person, the one who walks with God, looks quite ordinary, but there's also something extraordinary going on. And that, I would argue, is something that is utterly irritating if you have gotten comfortable in the desert. That is something that these people have that you want. At least that's how it was for me when I became a Christian. And it's especially irritating when you, whether you're Christian or not, have resigned yourself to a reality where God doesn't show up. Because this transnormal thing, the thing that is transcending what is ordinary, shows you that there's more to life. Now, Moses turned to see. The question is, what about you? Now, in verse 4, Moses finds out that very quickly, after he's turning to find what's going on, that God is speaking to him. God was waiting for him. And God knows him by name. Moses, Moses. And this shows us already here that God sees, that God is personal, that it is God who is reaching out. He's waiting to see whether we would turn. He is looking for the one who's gotten himself lost in the desert. This is who God is. But notice in verse 5, you may have initially come to God out of curiosity, and that's why some people come to God. And you might have found him inviting and personal, but very quickly, that is, if you deal with the real God, you will find that there's also something awesome about God. Don't come closer. God is holy. God is to be feared. There is a certain distance you have to keep. And so turning to God out of curiosity very quickly leads to a call of obedience. Take off your shoes. Which is a call to relinquish that which is not appropriate in the sight of God. And in Moses' case, it's the shoes. Now, why his shoes, you might wonder, and I wondered that too, so I read up a little bit on this. And one of the church fathers I read on this, Gregory of Nyssa, he explains that sandals were made of animal skin, something that is dead, and therefore something that is no good for walking with the living God. Which is why he argues also the priests in the Old Testament were barefoot. And he points out that in Matthew 10:10, when Jesus sends out the disciples to minister in Israel, to minister to the Jews, they were also told not to take sandals. And so he argues that this is a sign that he who walks with the living God must take off that which is dead, the flesh, the old self. And to be honest, I like this interpretation because it agrees, I find, with lots of stuff in the New Testament. And I find it to be true for us. When God calls, and when you turn, when you approach God, whether that's out of curiosity or out of a conviction of sin, you will find he is asking you to do something, usually to get rid of something. There is always a call to obedience, the obedience of faith, when you meet the real God. And of course, the only way to get rid of the flesh, to get rid of the dead stuff, is through Jesus. It's Jesus' death on the other tree, on that other mountain, that enables us to be in the presence of God and walk with him in the first place. Now, whether you like this interpretation of Gregory or not, whatever is going on here with the sandals, I think it's obvious that the point of this is God's holiness. It's in fact the first time in the Old Testament that the adjective holy is used. So the thing that we have to recognize about who God is, about the living God, is that he's holy, that he's other, that he's totally different. And it's exactly God's godness that demands that we obey and submit. That is, if we want to walk with him. That's the only way we can walk with him. But when you do that, you yourself will become sanctified. You will be holy, taken up and into the things of God, just as Moses here now is able to stay in the presence of God. When God then reveals to him, in verse 6, who he is, that he is the God of his fathers, the God of his tradition, the God of his family, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice that God identifies himself here through his relationship with humanity. This is four times repeated in this passage we have read. Four times it says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is big. Holy Creator God is known by his walk with man. He wants to be known by his walk with man, with you. And he invites Moses now to walk with him, just as his fathers have walked with him. You see, God is still in the business of looking after Abraham's family. In verse 7, we see that God hears, he sees, he's compassionate. God has not forgotten. He is the covenant-keeping God. He might appear distant and disinterested and uninvolved, but God's promises to Abraham stand, and redemption, therefore, is on God's agenda. God is committed. This is who God is. And that's why, we can now read in verse 8, he is coming down. He has come down. We serve a God who is not watching on stoically. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not the God of deism or of Aristotle or Plato. Our God sees, he hears, and he comes down. He involves himself in our history. This is the God who rescues. This is the God who saves his people from slavery and sin to lead them to a land of plenty, of promise, and of beauty. Christmas, we celebrated that God is Emmanuel, that he is God with us, that he has come to bring us home. That is why, I would argue, the incarnation, so that God is becoming man, that God is becoming flesh, is not a deviation from an earlier plan, but its culmination. That's why Jesus' coming precisely fits what we see here in Exodus and the rest of salvation history. God comes to dwell with man, to tabernacle with us, to lead us out of slavery into the promised land. And that is the God we serve. So just as a summary, who is God? God calls through extraordinary ways. God is personal. God is holy. God knows and sees. God is committed. God is a rescuer. Now, of course, the rest of Exodus 3 will repeat this. It tells us more about God, especially in verses 14 to 20, but this is going to be just along those lines. But I want to shift now, because there is an important shift taking place here in verses 7 to 9. And this shift teaches us how we start to walk with God. Have a look in verse 7. God says, I have indeed seen. I have heard. I am concerned about the people's affliction. So in verse 8, I have come down to rescue. And in verse 9, I have seen again. And I imagine when Moses heard this, he was thinking something like this. Oh, fantastic. We have been praying for this for years, 400 years. Fantastic. Thank you, God. But then God says this, verse 10, I'm going to send you. What? Beg your pardon? I thought you were going to do this, God. You see, here's the thing. Salvation is by God, it is for man, but it also comes through man. Salvation is by God, it is for man, but it comes also through man. This is God's pattern. Salvation comes from God walking with man, with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, all of them. And that has a lot of implications for us, how we walk with God. You see, who is God? God is incarnational. God has come down, and therefore, he is sending Moses to Pharaoh. This is the same pattern we see with Jesus. God has come down to save his people from their sin, and that's why he himself becomes man. Just as he sent Moses to Pharaoh, Jesus is sent to Pilate and then the cross. God is incarnational, and it is because God is incarnational that he wants to walk with us, work through us, and bring salvation to those who are under the yoke of slavery and sin. God's way of bringing salvation is through people. God seeks to indwell and send willing vessels. Think about this for a moment. God could have used angels. God could use angels right now to evangelize, to bring salvation to the ends of the earth. And I would think that's quite impressive because they got wings, right? They presumably can beam themselves from room to room. You can't really hurt them, so there wouldn't be any martyrs. And they're probably quite scary to look at. It would be a rather effective way to do stuff. Alternatively, God could just snip his finger and beam the entire nation out of Egypt to the border of Canaan or to Cyprus or to Hawaii. Or he could, whatever, clap his hands and all the Egyptians fall dead on the ground. But God doesn't do that. That's not God's pattern. That's not his way. God is incarnational. He works in, with, and through his creation. He wants to redeem humanity, and therefore salvation is not happening without humanity. Now that means many things, but initially I want to draw your attention to two things. Walking with God means to cooperate and to co-work with him to bring about salvation. And walking with God leads to conflict, and those go hand in hand. They are together, and they are on display in the entire Old Testament. God brings salvation, so he's using men such as Moses, Joshua, the judges, Samson, Saul, David, and the list goes on, the prophets, the disciples, to bring salvation. And that means then conflict, internal and external. And because of this, things are very messy. The whole book of Exodus shows us Moses is reluctant, Pharaoh is stubborn, and the Israelites are constantly griping, complaining, and disobeying. It's very messy. And I'm probably, if you have been involved in ministry, you'll have found that working with people is very messy. You see, Moses still had to face down Pharaoh, although God sent him. Moses still has to lead thousands of people through the desert. Moses still has to battle lots of enemies in and around the promised land. And God is not doing it without Moses. God wants Moses for this job. Why? Because God is incarnational. There's a lot of lessons that we are probably reluctant to learn from this. It means, for example, that salvation, that the salvation that God brings, though it is from God and by God, still means that we have to evangelize. We have to send people into missions. We have to make sacrifices. We still have to lead bunnies and discos. We still have to prepare an endless stream of sermons and talks. We still have to make flyers. We have to go to home groups, to prayer groups, even if we don't feel like it. We still have to make thousands of cups of tea and coffee, although that's not a bad thing. Because it is in and through these things that the kingdom of God comes. God's salvation does not come apart from us, and that is actually a very scary thought. However, there's a third point I want to add to this, and very quickly, because I want to balance this, what I just said, because it may have sounded to you as if it is all down to you. It ain't. God will do it as we obey and rely on him. See, this is the thing about the book of Exodus. The only explanation for what is going to happen for this mighty deliverance is not that Moses was doing it. The explanation is that God was doing it. God had come down. And so we, as the messengers, have to learn to fully rely on God, on his presence, on his strength, on his life, just as Moses had to learn this. And that's, by the way, why Moses failed, because later in Numbers, he thinks that he can bring water from the rock, right? And that's why he gets punished. But in verse 11 now, look at Moses' objection. Moses asks, "Who am I to go to Pharaoh? God, don't you realize what I'm up against here? What about Pharaoh?" You see, Pharaoh is the mightiest ruler in the entire ancient Near East at the time. He's the ruler of a mighty dynasty that has been there for thousands of years. And so Moses, in a sense, is quite similar to us because we essentially do the same thing. When God tells us to do something, how often do we tell God that we cannot possibly do what he's asking us to do? Because it's difficult or scary, right? Who am I to talk to my neighbor? Look at him, right? Who am I to lead my family? Have you seen them? I think there's actually legitimacy about realizing that God is asking you something difficult or impossible. And the reason why I think this is legitimate is because the way God replies in verse 12. Because God reassures Moses here. He's not scolding him, he's reassuring them. How is he reassuring him? With the most reassuring thing he could ever say: "I will be with you." You see, this is the key. This is the secret how we walk with God. If you don't hear anything else, listen to this. Moses was not asked to do something for God. He was asked to do something with God. You are not asked to do something for God. You're asked to do something with God. You're not supposed to talk to your neighbor for God, but with God. You're not preparing and preaching sermons for God. You do it with God. You're not doing bunnies or discos or whatever group you're leading for God. You do it with God. You're even making coffee with God. God is with us. He is walking with us. That should be our assurance. God is the incarnational God. God is the God with us, even in us. And it's in Exodus where we see this. God was working through Moses to bring about salvation. And in some sense, you could say God even ignores Moses' objection, because God isn't really interested in Moses' inability or the fact, you know, he can't do it. The answer Moses gets is, I am with you. And so the explanation for what would happen in the book of Exodus is, in fact, God. God is doing it. And Moses will realize this in hindsight. When he and the people, that's in verse 12, are back at the mountain, then you will know that I am with you, that I have done it. And I think it's true for us too, because it's often in hindsight, isn't that true, that we see God was with us, that he was doing it, that he was working through us. But Moses, verse 13, doesn't think it's enough. What about the Israelites? How on earth am I going to get them on board? How will they believe me when I tell them God sent me? That's just crazy. What am I going to tell them when they ask me your name, huh? Now, there are two potential problems. One, getting Israel to believe that Moses is sent by God, and two, getting Israel out of Egypt. Now, to get Israel out of Egypt is actually, to God, no problem whatsoever. But to get Moses and the Israelites to follow him is the much greater challenge. Why? Because it demands faith and the submission of their will, which is why God is now giving a very lengthy answer, verses 14 to 20. What is he showing him? He's showing him who he is. And then in chapter 4, he gives Moses means, signs to prove it, to authenticate these claims. The same pattern we find in the Gospels. Who is God? And then there will be signs to authenticate this message. I won't go into verses 14 to 20. I'll just, as a way of summary, go back to this. And I just added the last point, God is incarnational, because what you're going to see in verses 14 to 20 is exactly what we have already seen in the verses before, who God is. The only bit that is added is the fact that God knows what's going to happen. That's emphasized. God knows about Pharaoh's reluctance and all that it would take to rescue the Israelites. And so I'm fast-forwarding now to chapter 4, because at this point, Moses rightly asks what he should do if the Israelites do not believe him, trust him. What if they do not believe me or listen to me, and they should say, the Lord did not appear to you? And in fact, that's a quite sensible reply if you think about it, because if somebody comes to you and says, God told me something for you, he should probably have some way to back that up. And so Moses is given three signs in addition to the sign we already have in 4:12. You know, they go back to the mountain and in hindsight see that God has done it. There is now three more signs they're given. And these are signs of power to authenticate Moses and to display that God is able to deliver, that God is able to do it. And the first sign is the snake staff. And it's a rather curious thing, the snake staff, and you could do a whole study just following the staff in the book of Exodus. But look at verse 2 in chapter 4. What is it in your hand? What is that in your hand? That's what God says as reply to Moses' objection. It's a rather strange question, don't you think? Imagine this for a moment. Moses holds the staff. He had spent presumably decades with this stick, right? His shepherd's rod. He put it next to his bed when he went to sleep. Right? He probably was probably polished from the grease of his hands. His kids played with that stick, so he knew that stick. And yet, God asks him, what is that in your hand? Well, it's just a stick, my life. It represents, in a sense, his life as a shepherd, so in a sense, even his failure. throw it down. So Moses lets go of his staff, and to his amazement, it turns into a serpent. But have a look now. God tells him to pick up the snake by its tail. 4:4. What? God, don't you know snakes coil? They can bite? I mean, I don't know about snakes, but I think picking up a poisonous snake by the tail is not a good idea. And you see, look, Moses' response in verse 3, Moses ran from the snake. So he knows that thing is poisonous. It's dangerous. But yet God tells Moses to pick up that snake by the tail. And so he takes the snake by the tail, and it is okay. Why? Because God takes care of the head. And God is really the only one who should take care of the serpent's head. Now, remember, this thing is supposed to be a sign. The serpent is not a neutral symbol in the Bible. The serpent was the mouthpiece of the tempter in the garden with Adam and Eve. The serpent is said to strike at the heel of Eve. And in the Egyptian context that we're here, the serpent itself is a symbol of royalty, of power. Some of the pharaohs have like snake scepters. But more interesting, every pharaoh, every depiction of any pharaoh that you will see, ancient ones, they always have a snake on their head. So you see, the snake is actually the symbol for Lower Egypt, and the vulture is the symbol for Upper Egypt. So any depiction of a pharaoh you will ever find will have this snake on the forehead. And so some of the possible pharaohs that people think were the pharaoh in the Exodus, you have Ramesses II. He, you can see on a relief picture, he has the snake on his forehead. I don't think Ramesses II is a good pick for the Exodus pharaoh for various reasons. There's another one, Amenhotep II. He's earlier. He also has a snake on his forehead. And then, of course, this pharaoh, Giobranner, you have to be born before 80, I think, before the 80s to know who that is. He also has a snake on his forehead, right? But so I think the sign is this. Moses can touch, can handle the serpent because of God's power. God will take care of the dangerous reality that the snake represents. God is taking care of the head. Moses is therefore safely able to handle the tail. And perhaps the tail is actually a picture for Pharaoh himself, because the tail actually stands on his forehead. But you don't have to follow me in that interpretation. I think it's quite clear that what is supposed to be shown here is that God is powerful. And I think when we engage in evangelism, in mission, in dealing with people's sin and stubbornness, is it not true that God is the one who handles the real issues, the deeper realities, and that we are supposed to just hold the tail, as it were, as dangerous as that might be at times and challenging? I think what he's saying here is that the responsibility does not lie with us. Salvation is from God. God is the one who ultimately wages spiritual warfare. Again, Moses was not asked to do something for God. He was asked to do something with God. Much faster now, the two other signs, the white hand. Moses puts his hand on his rope, pulls it out. It is white. He puts it back in, pulls it out again. It's clean. A sign to show that God has power to smite and heal. And it's probably not leprosy that this Hebrew word is describing here. It's some kind of other skin disease that is also described in Leviticus 13 and 14. And it's probably a sign of divine displeasure. So whatever you make of this white hand, it clearly shows that God is the one who is empowered to smite and that he is the power to heal, which is exactly what we see in the 10 plagues. God is smiting and God can take it away. And then the water that turns into blood in verses 8 and 9, water is life in the desert. The Nile is a lifeline, especially the lifeline of Egypt, the life of Egypt. And it's quite clear that the one who's able to handle the Nile, so to speak, has power over everything. Whoever controls the Nile controls Egypt. And though the Egyptians think that the Nile is sacred, even a goddess, the one who's really in charge is God. God is the one who can deliver. And so these symbols, these signs, are there to authenticate Moses and the message. Now, as a summary, what keeps us from walking with God? That we fail to realize who God is. That we fail to realize how you walk with God, that God is incarnational in particular, that we are not meant to do something for God, but with God. And lastly, the last issue with us is that we flat out refuse God. That's what we do, and that's what Moses does here in the passage. Because in 4:13, Moses, he just flat out rejects, sent someone else. And it's at this point, after a very long discussion that Moses and God had, that God gets angry. Why? Because obedience and trust is not negotiable when you deal with the living God, especially after you have come to realize who God is. So your inability and your timidity, and I'm talking to myself, is no excuse. God's reply to Moses was to constantly point to himself as the answer. God is the object of faith. God's reply is to look to him and for us to look to his son, where salvation is found and life is found. And so the word for 2014 is this: God is not asking you to do something for him, but with him. And that's it. That's what it means to walk with God. So today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. Amen.